Wednesday afternoon, time for our bi-monthly conversation with MIBiz senior writer Mark Sanchez. How are you, sir?
I'm well. Yourself?
I'm very good. The economy remains strong, but what are you starting to see?
Yeah, there's always a however in everything you do with economic outlooks and forecasting. You know, it's that time of year again, just like we do in December and January. Those are good. That's a good time to kind of pause. Where we've been, where are we going? We like to do that as we approach mid-year here. We're in mid-June, middle of 2017 is coming up. So we thought we'd just take a look and check in with some of the economists around. How's Michigan doing? And, you know, the state's economy continues to be in good shape, far, far from where we were 6, 7, 8 years ago. And, boy, if you like slow, steady, you're going to like the rest of 2017, because basically the outlook say the latter half of 2017 will pretty much be much like the first half of 2017, with one caveat. You know, for the last 2 years, we've heard that automotive sales are expected to slow. Well, that's what's now happening. Automotive sales are easing up a little bit. It's not going to be a big drop, certainly nothing catastrophic that we saw a decade ago. But production levels are coming down a little bit, and they're coming down from some historic highs. We were building 17.5 million vehicles in North America last year. Some of the projections have them coming down to about 17.2 this year, 17.1 in 2018. That's from the University of Michigan. Another outlook from the folks at Comerica say maybe it'll drop to 16.5 next year. So that's a little pulling back of automotive production. What does that mean? Well, if you've been in Michigan for a while, you know that when automotive slows, even if it's just a little bit of easing, that works its way through the economy. So you can expect a little bit of slower growth in the second half of 2017 for Michigan and including West Michigan. We're not as auto-dependent as the Detroit area, but we have a lot of automotive suppliers. Fewer car sales, fewer truck sales, means fewer parts going into them. So you're going to see a little backing off in the manufacturing sector, although other sectors of the economy are supposed to and projected to remain in pretty good shape. So those will have to pick up the slack for job growth.
And what are those sectors here locally?
A lot in professional services, information technology, healthcare, hospitality is doing really well. Agriculture is doing well, food production and processing. So those are some of the areas you're going to see really for what job growth Michigan continues to experience. Those are the sectors that are going to be carrying the ball. Manufacturing's been going really well for a number of years. And in fact, you hear that kind of this labor shortage we're experiencing in some skilled positions that's holding the sector back a little bit. But manufacturing's kind of peaking right now this year because automotive has peaked. So the job growth really won't come from that sector anymore.
Housing, did you take a closer look at the home sale market?
I didn't get a good glimpse of that in some of the outlooks we talked to, but that's been in pretty good shape. What I remember is reading through some of those that the inventory is coming up a little bit, and if you're in the market for a home right now, you're competing with a number of folks.
And the news of the day, investors are waiting to hear from the Federal Reserve, may hike interest rates 0.25%.
The Open Market Committee meets today, might see another rate increase of 0.25% in the 1T interest rate. That'll push things up. It'll trickle through, and that'll push up maybe a little mortgage, car loans, consumer loans. It'll make borrowing a little more expensive if you're in the market to make a big capital purchase. For small businesses and businesses, capital purchases will get a little more, but those interest rates are more, when you're talking the large commercial credits and commercial loans, those are more, you can work through issues of that. But bottom line, you could see borrowing get a little more expensive today.
And as we were talking about the different sectors, so many companies in West Michigan, design is a focal point of what it is that they do. And Grand Valley State University's new Design Thinking Academy is aiming to embed design culture in local companies. So really spreading the wealth more than it already is spread among a number of companies in West Michigan.
Yes. Spread the thinking, the way of thinking, the mindset. You know, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about entrepreneurism and the increase in education and how colleges and universities treat entrepreneurism. And one of the points folks made with me was that even if you have a student who learns entrepreneurism and some of those principles, even if they never go out and start their own business, they still have that entrepreneurial thinking that they take to their employer for problem solving, for innovative and creative thinking. This is along somewhat of the same lines in design think. What does the world need more today than ever before? Innovation. Think about it. I'm here talking to you on a smartphone that 12 years ago didn't exist. So think about the future over the next decade, two decades. What type of innovations are going to come to the world over the next decade or two that we don't know about now as technology progresses? What does that take? That takes a design thinking in every business that brings an innovation to the marketplace. So this is something John Berry, who used to be with Herman Miller years ago. He's now at Grand Valley. And the university has started this new design thinking academy. And that's intended to just embed design thinking into students and the folks who go through this program. So when they're at their employer, they have a little different way of thinking of things. They think of it things of problem solving, innovation, creativity, and solutions they can help bring to their companies and their employer. Ultimately, that translates into the services and products that company brings to the marketplace.
What does that curriculum look like? What is design thinking? Is there a definition?
It's more of a way of thinking. It's, it'll have seminars on topics that range from improvisation to rapid prototyping and other activities along those lines, just to kind of get that design thinking mentality and mindset, make it intuitive in people. The old adage, is it a challenge or an opportunity that you face on a day-to-day basis or a long-term basis? So those are some of the ways is getting folks who have been, this is their livelihood, this is what they do, bringing them in to work with the students. And you have 25 companies here in the Grand Rapids area that are going to get involved in this, where the students in this academy then go out and do some work for these companies, get involved with these companies. And you have, for instance, Goodwill, Gordon Foods, Rockford Construction, I'm looking at the list here, Meyer, Herman Miller, Hayworth, Steelcase, Newell down there in Kalamazoo, and Wolverine Worldwide. That's just a few of the companies. So they're going to get involved in this and work with these students. And it's just kind of trying to bring that design thinking and then mindset more to students so they're better prepared when they're going out there for their employer to find the next innovations.
You and I, we talk a lot about healthcare. Right now, we're looking at a new healthcare bill that's now in the Senate. And it sounds as though there may be a new bill presented before summer recess in Washington. A lot of that talk also has to do with pharmaceuticals, drug costs. You're looking at an analysis finding escalating specialty drug costs more than offset savings from generics.
Yeah, and not just the specialty drugs, these high-cost biologics, but also drugs that have maybe been on the market for a while, but they're still under patent protection. This information comes to us from the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. That's kind of the umbrella organization for Blue plans across the country. And it shows that when there's the drugs that are protected by patent in the U.S. and they have no generic competitor, increase more than 25% per year over a period of about 9 years from 2007 to 2016. That's the rate more than double for all other medications on the market. And those drugs protected by patent, they account for 63% of all drug spending in the U.S. That's more than the 29% rate, about double the rate for patents for the other drugs. So what you're seeing, we used to talk a lot about chronic medical conditions and illnesses that were really driving up healthcare costs in America, diabetes, asthma, heart condition, cardiovascular disease. Well, now in the last few years, you've thrown these escalating drug costs into the equation. And I've said it before, I don't know how employers do it and still manage to maintain employee health benefits for people, because these drug costs, they're a big deal. Every employer knows it. The health plans and health insurers are trying to get a grip on it, find out from the pharmaceutical companies, why are these costs, these unit prices increasing so much each year? And I would invite folks to go and take a look at that Blue Cross Blue Shield Association report. It's on the website of the organization, and to just see some of what's occurring out there with these pharmaceutical costs. And if you're an employer, what should you do? Well, you've got some difficult decisions to make. Nobody wants to deny care from their employees. If you have an employee that gets ill, especially if they're if it's a serious illness, you want them to get the care that they deserve and they need, obviously. But if you're self-insured or if you have a way you're rated, this could really send your costs up. So there are some things that employers should have already done, and if they haven't, they need to look at it, and that's moving to these multi-tier, 4 or 5-tier drug pharmacy benefits, and sit down, and if you have some professional advice who works with you on your health benefits, talk to them about how you should position yourself to protect you from some of these rising costs, because they're not going away for a while.
We hear this debate over price controls. Price controls are in other countries. When you talk with Blue Cross Blue Shield and others, what is the thought out there when it comes to the idea of implementing price controls?
You know, they're pretty careful when you bring up that issue in the conversation with them. They don't want to really start advocating that type of public policy. They have to deal with the reality that's in front of them. They have to deal with the circumstances in the law that's in effect right now. So they shy away sometimes when you start asking those questions about, you know, those broader public policy implications. Because, yes, you're right, there are other countries in the world, and pretty much most of them, they have price controls on drugs. And the U.S. is really just about the only nation that gives patent protection without any type of price controls. That's not an advocacy statement. That's just the way it is. And there are folks who do advocate that price controls is one way of doing it. There are folks on the other side that said, look, if we don't make these margins, we can't price these things based on what we think the market can sustain. That's going to dry up innovation, and you're not going to get these new drugs out there on the marketplace that are curing previously incurable diseases. You know, a year ago, I wrote the story about Harvoni. This is a drug that came on the market in the last 2 or 3 years. It cures hepatitis C, a previously incurable lethal disease, can now be cured with this drug. But this drug's very expensive. I've heard people tell me it's roughly $80,000 or more for a drug regimen. Well, but what if that expenditure prevents somebody from having to go through a liver transplant? And what's the cost of that? Plus, what's the cost of a lifetime of anti-rejection drugs? So that's the era we're in. Yes, some of these drugs cost a lot of money to develop. They cost a lot of money to buy and purchase and prescribe. What's the social benefit? If it's your lethal disease they're curing, well, you're willing to have that money paid by your health insurer. So that's kind of the question that I guess everybody just needs to confront. What's the cost? What's the value?
But I also see in your story that Priority Health, it tries to work with pharmaceutical companies seeking out rebates.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting thing. And we've talked about value-based contracting here on this program before, where the health insurers are basing their payments to doctors and hospitals more on outcomes, how that patient actually do. Well, this is similar. If a patient goes on a drug, let's say for cancer, that drug doesn't work for them, or they have an adverse reaction or side effect that they can't keep taking that drug, Priority Health goes back to that pharmacy benefit manager or the pharmaceutical company, and they'll negotiate a rebate, sometimes up to 50%. So there's a simple market force coming to work there. Something doesn't work, you take it back to the store, right? There's a bit of consumerism coming into the healthcare market.
MIBiz senior writer Mark Sanchez, thank you so much.
Talk to you again.